Chapter 3. A Significant Increase. September 8, 2017. Commander Jonathan White spent his career working to put the best interests of his clients first, the first principle of social work, and he suspected the Trump administration was planning to do the exact opposite in separating migrant families. From the moment John Kelly, who was promoted to Trump's chief of staff in July 2017, admitted he was considering family separations as a way to deter migration to the United States, White had been doing everything he could to keep track of the policy's development and implementation. If separations happened like it was suggested they should on Valentine's Day in the fourth floor suite at Customs and Border Protection headquarters, it would be unprecedented. And the children taken from their parents would end up in his care, housed in one of the roughly 100 shelters for unaccompanied migrant children run by the Office of Refugee Resettlement within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. Neither he nor his colleagues were ready. In the early hours of the morning, White noticed a report by Julia Ainslie, who had left Reuters to join NBC News, that Immigration and Customs Enforcement was poised to conduct the largest raid on undocumented immigrants in American history. Dubbed Operation Mega, it would target for deportation 8,400 undocumented migrants who were living in the United States illegally, precisely the terror the Catholic Church was preparing for in Los Angeles. ICE wouldn't confirm Ainslie's reporting and issued the standard denial that the agency was, quote, not able to speculate about potential future targeted enforcement actions. This didn't sit well with White, who emailed Scott Lloyd, the boyish Trump-appointed 38-year-old director of ORR. Lloyd, who before being tapped by Trump worked as an attorney for the Catholic fraternal organization Knights of Columbus and in the Bush administration's Health and Human Services Department, had never resettled refugees before taking the ORR role in March 2017. He had, however, advocated vociferously against abortions in his previous jobs, and he would continue to at ORR. Lloyd was White's boss, but White felt it was Lloyd who would need guidance for the day ahead. I'm betting tomorrow that ICE leadership will want to talk to you about their planned Operation Mega, which is expected to net thousands of undocumented immigrants in what everyone is discussing. The NGOs have been all abuzz, and tonight it's even in the mainstream news, to be the largest immigration enforcement action in modern history. If it comes up, our biggest request, I think, should be this. Please don't separate minors from family units and refer them to us. Family unit is the term the Department of Homeland Security, under which the Border Patrol and ICE are situated, uses to describe children together with biological parents or legal guardians. White was intimately familiar with the terminology. In 2012, 2014, and again in 2016, his agency ran out of bed space when surges of unaccompanied migrant children and families, mostly from Central America, showed up at the southern border. Because of the backlog, young children were literally piling up in Border Patrol stations, sleeping in the squalor of jail facilities built decades earlier when most border crossers were Mexican men looking for seasonal work. In response to images of the conditions being released, the Obama administration had opened temporary facilities to house the children on military bases in Oklahoma, Texas, and California. Back then, families weren't Commander White's responsibility. They would go into ICE custody and be held at controversial family detention centers or be paroled into communities where they likely had family members. But now the Trump administration was suggesting that families would be broken apart, parents would be prosecuted and jailed, and their children would be taken away and placed into the system operated by Commander White. Without proper planning, that would surely overwhelm the ORR system, if not break it entirely, he believed. Later that day, Ainslie followed up on her initial report with an update. ICE was calling off the raid. For White, bullet dodged. He would not have to rely on Lloyd to protect the migrant children in their care and custody. but it wasn't because of the political pressure that White had told his boss was building. Due to the current weather situation in Florida and other potentially impacted areas, along with the ongoing recovery in Texas, U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, ICE, had already reviewed all upcoming operations and has adjusted accordingly, spokeswoman Sarah Rodriguez told Ainsley, referring to Hurricane Irma bearing down on Miami and the aftermath of Hurricane Harvey in Houston. There is currently no coordinated nationwide operation planned at this time. The priority in the affected areas should remain focused on life-saving and life-sustaining activities. By the time Ainsley received the statement from ICE, Irma was a Category 5 megastorm, tracking directly for Florida's east coast. But Boca Raton Mayor Susan Haney wasn't worried about residents who hadn't yet stocked up on supplies. "Well, they have time this morning," she said live on MSNBC. The banner at the bottom of the TV said Irma was 281 miles southeast of Nassau, Bahamas, and packing a wind speed of 150 miles per hour, potentially catastrophic. "The weather here is still beautiful." The screen was divided into a triple box, showing empty shelves at a local supermarket, thousands of cars evacuating on Interstate 75, and the surf churning on South Beach, nature's advance warning that something was brewing offshore. 1,000 miles to the north in Washington, D.C., those images were playing live on television monitors as Tom Price, the Secretary of Health and Human Services, received a briefing from aides about HHS's readiness for Irma. Also there were Dr. Robert Kadlec, Price's Assistant Secretary for Preparedness and Response, the life-saving arm of HHS known as ASPR, and Kadlec's Chief of Staff, Chris Meekins, who was across the room behind a bank of computer monitors in the room known as the Secretary's Operations Center, or SOC. Kadlec and Meekins were ready for this moment. In a natural disaster, ASPR is tasked with preparing for and recovering from public health emergencies. "If you want doctors, nurses, paramedics to be able to supplement once needed in given communities there, that's ASPR's job," Meekins later said about his role on a Politico podcast. That afternoon in the SOC, my face materialized on the TV screen playing MSNBC. At 7 minutes before 3 o'clock, I reported live from the back of an ambulance as we bounced around the emergency vehicle on our way to conduct wellness checks on elderly residents. From there, we rebased our coverage to the western part of the state, where we spent days chasing Irma's hard left turn. We ultimately rode out the storm in Naples, where I performed the time-honored and ridiculous tradition of dodging terracotta tiles on live television as she made a direct hit. When Irma passed, we emerged unscathed, but in the darkness of the next morning, veteran camera operator Dana Roker and I discovered our rental Suburban did not. Its roof had been split in two by a projectile palm tree. Though dozens were killed as a result of the storm, the worst-case scenario projections reviewed in the SOC never materialized. ASPR would refocus on a plethora of other urgent threats, including, but not limited to, a global outbreak. "I can't talk about the lists I might see," Meekins presciently told reporter Dan Diamond just before COVID-19 exploded worldwide. "What I will say is the H7N9 strain of the flu pandemic that is circulating in China is a great threat, and I think it could be a real problem going forward." While temporarily, at least, Kadlec and Meekin's fears were assuaged, Commander White's were not. He was prescient, too. Across the street from the SOC at ORR headquarters, White saw a disaster of another sort barreling towards HHS like a superstorm or global health emergency. Within months, they would all be in the SOC together, as it would again become operational for a disaster, this time the man-made one that Commander White was worried about. Family separations. September 27th, 2017. Inside the Department of Health and Human Services, some in the small D.C. headquarters of the division caring for migrant children were starting to feel like they had a second job, sleuthing. Employees of the Office of Refugee Resettlement were talking, and they suspected, based on data and anecdotal reports trickling in, that the Trump administration would follow through on then Homeland Security Secretary, now White House Chief of Staff, John Kelly's threat to separate families to scare others away from coming to the United States. Kelly had quickly backed away from the policy after he announced its consideration in March, but evidence continued to pile up. Still, nobody could say for sure. Pinning down whether or not wide-scale separations were happening, where they were happening, and who was ordering them wasn't easy. We had to be detectives, I was told, just to be able to answer the question, are these legitimate separations or for deterrence? By fall, it did not take much effort for pieces of the puzzle to begin to fall into place regularly. Something was happening. Word made its way back quickly to ORR after a meeting about migration with members of the White House on an unseasonably hot fall Wednesday. In an air-conditioned room in a Washington, D.C. law firm as temperatures outside broke 90, Trump administration officials talked obliquely about their plans for migrants coming to the United States. That evening, Commander White received an email about the meeting from an ORR colleague who was there and overheard them. DHS policy is working on a family separation policy again to send all children to ORR. They don't understand that ORR has its own obligations, and these types of cases often end up with parent repatriated and kid in our care for months pending home studies, international legal issues, etc. I will try to get some info unless you and Scott already have it. White wrote back 4 hours later, in the early hours of Thursday morning. No, I definitely will need all the info you can find. Later that day, Commander White scheduled a meeting between 1 and 2 in the afternoon. The subject, find out about separation policy. Answers for any non-political inside ORR would not be easy to come by. On the occasions that I raised it, White said later during congressional testimony, I was advised that there was no policy that would result in the separation of children and parents. We always knew, one of White's ORR colleagues told me, we were dealing in an environment where people wouldn't acknowledge what we knew was happening. October 11th, 2017. Homestead, Florida dodged a bullet when Hurricane Irma rolled through. The city had been devastated by Hurricane Andrew 25 years earlier, but damage this time around wasn't as severe. Local reports documented avocado harvests that were cut short and landscaping palm tree orchards that were blown into chaos, but fears of tens of thousands of displaced residents never materialized. The farms would eventually recover and repairs were underway to the roof of the airplane hangar belonging to the 125th Detachment of the Florida Air National Guard on the Homestead Air Reserve Base, home to the F-15 fighter jets that would shake the neighborhoods below on their way out and over the Everglades for training flights. Around the corner from the Air Reserve Base, the Homestead Temporary Shelter for Migrant Kids, on the property of the U.S. Department of Labor's former Job Corps site, survived too. Homestead, as it is known for short, was first opened in the summer of 2016, during the Obama administration, as an overflow facility for the thousands of migrant children arriving unaccompanied in the United States. Shelters all across the country were at or near capacity, and the temporary facility, operated by a private company, not a nonprofit like most ORR shelters, provided a pressure relief valve for the system. When Donald Trump was elected, numbers of all migrants, including children crossing the southern border illegally, dropped precipitously. Trump officials proudly boasted about the Trump effect, migrants staying home because of fear about his tough talk. In April 2016, 48,511 people were taken into custody at the southern border. In April 2017, only 15,798 were, an unheard-of low. Or our shelters that had been packed sat nearly empty that month, and Homestead discharged its last migrant child. Now, 10 months into the Trump administration, and with no significant change to border policy, migrants and the smugglers who helped them were calling the president's bluff. Numbers began to tick upward, but still remained shy of the record lows set during the Obama administration. Understanding this, and with the specter of family separations on the horizon, Commander Jonathan White, thinking like the emergency manager he was, wanted to prepare. That meant making sure there were enough beds to care for a sudden surge, like he had seen three times during the Obama administration, of migrant children coming into his custody. He drafted a memo for Trump-appointed ORR Director Scott Lloyd to send to his superior, another Trump appointee and former George W. Bush administration official Steve Wagner, the acting assistant secretary for children and families. White and Lloyd did not see eye to eye, particularly around the issue of abortions for girls and young women in the custody of ORR. Lloyd, a devout Catholic and then the father of seven children, instituted a policy soon after his appointment in early 2017 that mandated any migrant girl seeking an abortion would require his direct approval, and White found it reprehensible. As the policy was argued in court, White continued to work closely with Lloyd, attempting to prepare for the family separation policy he feared was coming. Lloyd sent the memo to Wagner, making White's case why both should advocate for the Trump administration to again prepare to use the facility. In FY 2018, there are multiple threats which could trigger a requirement for temporary influx shelter, of which the key threats are rapid growth in referrals due to increased migration of UAC across Southwest border, policy or operational change at DHS resulting in rapid growth in referrals, e.g., separation of children from family units for designation as UAC, or decline in discharges, e.g., enforcement actions against sponsors. Natural disaster, major grantee issue, or other unplanned event resulting in a sudden or rapid loss of existing permanent shelter capacity. Any of these threats could cause ORR to exceed the 85% capacity target faster than additional bed capacity could be added. Though the memo cited three factors that would cause Homestead to be called into service, it's not difficult to deduce the reason it was written. Natural disaster? Unlikely. If a natural disaster were to strike, Homestead itself could also be a primary target, as it was during Irma. Increased migration? Maybe. Numbers were starting to trend back upward after all-time lows due to President Trump's harsh rhetoric. Policy or operational change? Bingo. In drafting the memo, White finally memorialized what could create a man-made backup at ORR shelters scattered throughout the country. One reason would be increased scrutiny of sponsors, family members or friends of the unaccompanied migrant children who arrived in the United States by themselves, some of whom may be undocumented. That alone would slow the discharge rate of children from the shelter system. But the other option was the potential policy that had all of ORR talking: family separations. If they needed the facility, which could house thousands of children at any given time, it wouldn't take long, Lloyd wrote to Wagner in the memo. ORR has assessed and validated the site to be logistically suitable for activation to receive UAC within 30 to 45 days, if required. October 13th, 2017. What are we looking at? There are a total of 8 prototypes, said Roy Villarreal, the Border Patrol Deputy Chief of the San Diego sector, dressed in a green uniform with short shirt sleeves on this chilly morning. 4 of which are constructed out of concrete, and 4 that are constructed out of alternate material. These are pretty tall. They are 18 to 30 feet tall. Villarreal and I were in Otay Mesa, California, 6 miles east of the San Ysidro port of entry, where I saw that meth busted 6 months earlier. It's here, on a stretch of land in between the two existing border fences, the original 6 or 7 foot one, made out of temporary steel aircraft runways used during the Vietnam War, and the secondary fence, a much larger wall, maybe 18 or so feet, and made of metal mesh, that President Trump's border wall prototypes were taking shape. Villarreal was touring me here, and President Trump had found the money to build these prototypes, despite the fact that crossings across the country were on track to be as low as ever without his wall. Will this lower the numbers even further? It's hard to gauge, Villarreal says. There's always going to be some form of crime, or in this case, illegal migration. Can we do our job better? Absolutely. And I think that these walls are going to contribute towards that. Fair enough, I think. A big drop in the number of people crossing in this area, what's known as the San Diego sector, coincided with the building of the fencing in the Clinton and the Bush administrations. So currently we have just under 700 miles of fencing along the border. We don't have any intentions of fencing off the entire southwest border. It's not necessary, Villarreal told me. At least he's being honest. So what happens now, I ask? Does the president come out here and literally say, I pause briefly, preparing my best Trump impression while turning toward a tan color prototype, half white bollard on the bottom and half white sheets on the top. Okay, I like that one. We're going to test it for breachability, for the subterranean aspect. Can we dig under it? Can we cut through it? Can we scale over it? Before either of us knew it, I heard producer Arnie Hakala tell me to look up. He fired up the camera he was holding, a Canon 5D, and zoomed in to see Border Patrol agents on horseback running up to a family who had climbed over the short primary fence and dropped into the United States. What happened? I shouted, and then I realized. People are crossing. Villarreal was standing next to me, and I kept talking. Looks like a small group of three people just jumped over in the middle of the day. A girl there with a pink backpack. Can you explain to me what's going on? I was far more excited by what I was seeing than was Villarreal. This is a reality of everyday border enforcement. The United States is still the draw, the ultimate draw, for people that have dire situations where they're at. We're going to continue to witness this. It plays out on a regular basis for us. And it did just here, just now. Just now, yeah. The family had sat down in the dirt as agents rode up on horses. As they were being apprehended by agents on horseback, they told the Americans they wished to declare asylum. They were stood up and taken away to be booked and processed at a nearby Border Patrol station. Just weeks later, in the same Border Patrol sector, another family declaring asylum would set off a chain reaction, ultimately affecting thousands. November 16, 2017. Commander White's team spent October gathering a year's worth of data about the kids in their care. He now had in hand the proof to show that an increasing number of children were being taken from their parents, despite the lack of an official policy announcement by the Trump administration. Scott Lloyd, who consistently told White that he had heard nothing from the White House about a family separation policy, had given him the go-ahead to investigate what he suspected was happening. In a phone conversation with Lloyd, acting ICE Director Thomas Homan, and Kevin McAleenan, acting Commissioner of Customs and Border Protection, White explained that ORR shelters were caring for an increased number of children who had said they were separated from their parents. At McAleenan's request, Commander White agreed to follow up with an email providing more information. The next morning, he broke down the specifics for McAleenan, also copying Homan, who was in charge at ICE. McAleenan was present for the meeting with White, in which implementing separations were first raised on Valentine's Day 2017. Also copied was Scott Lloyd. While a small number of referrals each month have been separation cases, generally as a result of criminal apprehensions of parents accompanying unaccompanied alien child, ORR has noticed a significant increase in recent months, both in raw numbers and in particular as a proportion of total referrals. What Commander White was saying would have been clear to McAleenan. Yes, separations had happened in the past, including during the Obama administration, but only in the limited circumstance of a family being apprehended and the parent or parents in that family committing a criminal act. Now it appeared more and more families were being separated for no other reason than they had crossed the border illegally, and they were being charged with the crime of illegal entry. This had never happened in a widespread fashion before. Starting in July 2017, shelters and advocates for children in them started to see an unusual slowdown in the time it took for unaccompanied minors to be discharged from ORR custody. The percentage of separated kids as a proportion of the total referred to HHS was also ballooning. The year before, in October 2016, the Obama administration had separated 60 children from their parents out of nearly 7,500 children sent to ORR. In October 2017, 91 kids sent to ORR were separated out of less than 3,000 cases. Commander White attached a spreadsheet compiled by his ORR colleague, Jim De La Cruz, with individual data on each of the 170 children taken from their parents in September and October alone. Nobody outside the government, other than lawyers and service providers on the ground, had much of a clue. Not even all of the federal agencies that should have been sharing information in order to ensure the well-being of the children in their custody. As you can see from that data, minors separated by DHS from FMUA and declared UAC are often TAs, 12 years of age and younger, and in a significant number of cases, are very young, ages 1 to 5. White wrote, FMUA means family unit apprehensions, and TAs signified tender-aged, often babies, as Commander White laid out. This was a big deal. Separations for reasons other than safety and security of the child were surging, either a highly unlikely coincidence or evidence of something coordinated afoot. Either way, Commander White and his colleagues at ORR were, despite his best efforts, unprepared for a sudden surge in children placed in their custody. As he had previously, he warned the children may literally not have a place to go once separated. These UAC require specialized licensed beds, different under state licensure law from most licensed UAC beds, and the numbers of these very young UAC resulting from separation has on some dates resulted in shortfalls of available beds licensed for very young TAs. UAC referred through separation generally have longer length of care in ORR custody than other UAC. The message was clear, if not explicitly laid out in the email. Whoever had decided to start separating these children, and wherever it was happening along the border, a lack of planning for its repercussions was breaking the system used by the federal government to safely care for children. White was blowing the whistle to the leadership responsible for the separations he was seeing. McAleenan had to do something. The evidence White had in hand didn't look good, particularly because they were both in the room when the policy was floated weeks after Trump took office. He now owed White a response. That day, Jose celebrated his 14th birthday in Petén, Guatemala. It was an unremarkable day. "We didn't do anything," his dad Juan recalled. At the house on the hill with the arches and palm trees, a pickup truck parked on the side across from the big field, it was quiet. They didn't invite lots of people. It wasn't customary. Jose's 8 and 2-year-old sisters were there, and so was his mom, Maria. There were no signs that 6 months away, the family would change forever. "I wasn't thinking of leaving Guatemala. I was with my family, working in a business. I had a store, and that took care of our family," he said. They celebrated together, like their family always did. Jose didn't know it, but his 14th birthday would be his last in his home country. The next morning, Saturday, November 18th, Makalainen received a daily summary of news articles referencing Customs and Border Protection. The third on the list was a BuzzFeed article about a father claiming Border Patrol agents separated him from his one-year-old son. While this story has yet to be widely reported in other media outlets, it is gaining traction on Twitter since BuzzFeed first ran the article in the early morning hours. Makalainen forwarded the email to other officials, including Carla Provost, the acting chief of the Border Patrol. "Do we have any info on number three below?" he asked. Provost sent Makalainen's question to Gloria Chavez, the deputy chief of the Border Patrol's operations division. "Going to need to know what's going on in EPT on Monday based on what you brought up yesterday," she told Chavez, referring to the El Paso sector of the agency. Chavez responded that afternoon. "T4, Chief, let me dig over the weekend and get more info. I need to confirm a few items and make sure I interpreted it correctly." Chavez wasn't the only one looking into what was going on in El Paso. Meanwhile, President Trump was focused on another part of his immigration agenda, and so was I. November 22, 2017. With apprehensions along the border continuing to rise and unable to secure funding for his big, beautiful border wall, President Trump and Congress became locked in a budget stalemate. Trump's bargaining chip was what he would do about his September decision stopping deferred action for childhood arrivals, DACA, the Obama-era executive action that gave protected status to the 689,000 undocumented people who were brought to the United States by their parents as children, through no fault of their own. If no deal was reached in March of 2018, recipients would start to lose their legal status. At first, President Trump sounded supportive of a deal. "We're working on a plan for DACA," he said in early September before he boarded Marine One at the White House. "The wall will come later." But a month later, a deal still hadn't materialized, and the federal government was on course for a shutdown. If no deal on DACA was reached, by March all recipients would be at risk of deportation. Since a quarter of them had U.S.-born kids, American citizens, any deportation would leave the family a choice. Self-separate, leaving their children behind with family members or friends, or bringing them with. In Mexico, this was not something new. So as always, we went there to see for ourselves. Again, Mitch Koss and I drove down from Los Angeles. As you approach the border, you either get off at Camino de la Plaza, where the green freeway sign has highlighted in yellow, "Last USA Exit," or drive into Tijuana, as I did accidentally in 2014. I exited and pulled into the parking lot to, as I'd get used to, rendezvous with the others in our NBC team. The lot was familiar to us now, as was the outlet mall across the freeway. We all piled in the same van, the most efficient way for us to cross the border as a team without running into any unnecessary delays. For some, crossing the border like this was a daily routine. For me, it remained novel and every detail fascinating, choreographed so that we stayed on track. We stopped at a local hotel chain to pick up our trusted fixer, Mariana, whom Mitch met years earlier. She's a journalist herself and in her spare time helps us out when we head to her part of the world. The story we were pursuing today was her idea. She hopped in the car, we did the double kiss thing, she hugged the crew, and we were off. 50,000 foreign-born students attended school in the Mexican border state of Baja California. 30,000 of those children lived in Tijuana. The majority, the Mexican government told us, were United States citizens. We arrived at a public school Mariana had arranged for us to tour. After we were inside the gates and guided into a classroom by an administrator, I quickly understood the choice these families were making. I was introduced to a young man about half my size, hair slicked to the side and matted down with gel. The cardigan sweater over his white polo was dark blue. "What's your name?" I asked him. "George," he said back right away, clearly understanding my English. "George? Jacob. Nice to meet you. Where are you from, George? I'm from Bakersfield, California. You're from the United States? Yes.
Are you an American citizen?
Yes. He paused. And Mexican. My dad was deported. So how long have you lived here?
Just barely a year and a half.
I asked how different his life was here compared to the United States.
Very different. I've actually cried sometimes. I miss my friends.
George missed his friends, but he was still in the close care of his dad, George Sr., whom I met when he came to pick up his son from school. He wore a ball cap with the logo of a commercial printing chain in Southern California and rectangular plastic glasses just like mine. His white t-shirt was tucked into his jeans, which were clinging to his skinny frame. On his feet were work boots, which he'd use after picking up George Jr. and going back to the house he was renovating. We sat together on the staircase outside of one of the classrooms, math equations painted on each stair behind us in the green, white, and red of the Mexican flag.
So you got deported and they followed you here?
Yeah, basically, he told me.
Can I ask you what happened?
Yeah, I got in trouble. I was in drug trafficking. After he served time back at home and was deported, he found his way here. We followed George and his son in their silver Toyota pickup truck to the beachfront house he was fixing up on Rosarito Beach. With a huge hotel in the distance and horseback riders going along the shore, little George rode his bike onto the sand. His dad told him, he said, "This is a million-dollar view." He pointed to the waves of the Pacific Ocean crashing on the beach, the same ocean and same waves crashing a short drive to the north, separated by a steel fence jutting out into the water.
So you would trade a million-dollar view to go back to Bakersfield?
For a million-dollar family. We said goodbye to the Georges, dropped off Mariana, and headed back north, waiting in the hour-long line to get through the same San Ysidro port of entry, where I had seen government agents bust the smuggling of multiple kilos of meth in February. Back then, and again now, there was a line of humans on foot forming next to the epic queue of vehicles we were now idling in. Just like the tens of thousands of cars crossing daily, tens of thousands of people do, too. Many to go to work or school or visit family and friends. There was another line I didn't see, with another group of people I missed, too. Forming apart from the throng of daily border crossers was an entry for asylum seekers, people in flight from their home countries and seeking refuge in the United States. These individuals wouldn't have documents scanned and handed right back to them. They would be taken into the basement of the port of entry and put into cells with cinderblock walls, gray linoleum floors, and metal toilets while their fates were decided. Those who have seen the process describe it as mechanized and cold. They, quote, pass through a chain-link gate and stand at a counter to answer questions from officers sitting behind computers. Mothers and children sit together beneath a large American flag hanging in a waiting room. Meanwhile, migrants shuffle back and forth from holding cells to the cafeteria or showers, walking in single file with their hands behind their backs, local public broadcaster KQED reported. 21 days before I unknowingly drove right over this secret jail, a Congolese mother and her daughter were separated from each other after having been detained there. They were moved to what she described as a makeshift hotel, and on what she believes was the fourth day of her detention, her daughter was taken from her screaming. The mother was taken to an adult immigration jail in San Diego, and her daughter was sent to a shelter in Chicago. When she was told her daughter was in Chicago, she did not know what the word meant. All the while, above ground, life went on at the Las Americas Premium Outlets and at the parking lot across the freeway. Once through the border crossing and back in the States, we returned to that parking lot. I said goodbye to everyone, shook hands, hopped out of the team van, got in my car, and drove home to Los Angeles, clueless about the separated mother and daughter
who would soon be engaged in a fight not just for their right to be reunited, but for thousands of others as well. November 25th, 2017. Under a perfectly sunny late autumn sky, dozens of Border Patrol agents and other law enforcement officials gathered outside Our Lady of Guadalupe Church in El Paso to watch the body of fellow agent Rogelio Martinez placed into a hearse to be transported for burial. A local fire truck flew a giant American flag off its outstretched ladder as firefighters in blue uniforms stood at attention below. Bagpipes played. It was Thanksgiving weekend. Agent Martinez died after what initial reports suggested was a rock striking his head. His partner was also badly injured. President Trump tweeted about the death of Agent Martinez, indicating he was murdered, despite a lack of evidence. He promised to, quote, seek out and bring to justice those responsible for the killing. A tragedy, he implied, made the case for his promised border wall, which wasn't even under construction or anywhere close to it. Months later, the FBI declared it found no evidence of an attack against Agent Martinez, giving credence to an alternate theory: he may have accidentally fallen into the roadside culvert in which he was discovered. The lack of certainty didn't stop President Trump from using the death as political fodder to justify his border wall. But with the project and his promise Mexico would pay for it in jeopardy, the Trump administration pushed forward on policies that would have the same effect. This policy wall was not one made of steel or concrete, but of terror. The night Agent Martinez was laid to rest in El Paso, the plan Commander White suspected was underway, despite assurances otherwise, was publicly revealed to be taking place in the same city. In a bombshell story, Lomi Creel of the Houston Chronicle reported the Trump administration was following through on the policy my colleague Julia Ainslie had uncovered it was considering back in March, and with Jim De La Cruz, Commander White documented systematic separation of parents and children who crossed the southwest border illegally. Ripping families apart had become regular U.S. government practice, if a secret one. The Chronicle, prudently, had used the word questionable to describe the policy in its headline. Indeed, despite Creel's report and the insistence of her sources that family separations were happening, what exactly that looked like would be an unknown until the Trump administration acknowledged the policy, and more important, until outsiders were able to get inside government facilities to see what was actually happening for themselves. Testimonials from child advocates and attorneys cited by Creel were the first public documentation that separations were happening. The Trump administration was charging migrant parents of families apprehended at the border with the federal crime of illegal entry and rendering their children unaccompanied, placing them in the custody of the Child Refugee Program run by Commander White. Creel and the Chronicle were able to identify 22 separation cases. Additionally, she reported there were dozens more cases like them, according to attorneys. The Trump administration, while denying the policy existed, found justification in the increasing number of Central American migrants arriving to seek asylum, even though overall numbers of border crossers remain near all-time lows. The idea was to deter them from making the journey, as then-Secretary Kelly had explained on CNN. Deterrence-based immigration policy was nothing new. Whether it was the first wave of border fencing put into place by the Clinton administration, the creation of the Department of Homeland Security at the same time as a massive expansion of the Border Patrol by the Bush administration, or the record number of deportations by the Obama administration, the prevention through deterrence enforcement philosophy, an official name coined in 1994, has never stopped the most desperate from coming to the United States. Not even word of dog kennel-style cages, La Perrera, used by the Obama administration to hold a surging number of unaccompanied Central American minors in 2014, made people want to turn back. Among these outrage-inducing immigration policies carried out over decades, unnecessarily separating families was considered uniquely reprehensible by doctors, social workers, and immigration lawyers, which quickly became apparent. Families fleeing the threats of violence, persecution, and hunger found themselves unable to find their own children, taken by the American state even after their criminal proceedings ended. Parents are being denied access to their children without any due process, federal public defender Maureen Franco told Creel. Even the worst drug addicts still have rights to their children, but here we are just removing them without even a hearing. Creel found that parents could not find their children because of what U.S. Magistrate Judge Miguel Torres described as a, quote, limited and often non-existent lack of information about the well-being and whereabouts of their minor children from whom they were separated at the time of their arrest. Her reporting not only uncovered what was happening, but it revealed how after separations occurred and parents were charged with crimes, reunifications with children were complicated, and in some cases not happening at all. This is a huge problem, an assistant public defender in San Diego emailed Creel after spending 2 weeks trying to locate a 5-year-old child taken from her client. The Chronicle had the evidence in hand, but the government was denying its own policy. Creel reported a Customs and Border Protection lawyer as claiming the, quote, Border Patrol does not have a blanket policy requiring the separation of family units. Of course, that's exactly what was happening, and the evidence was now published by the Houston Chronicle for the world to read. The United States of America, a nation as thoroughly defined by immigration as any on earth, was deliberately breaking apart families seeking asylum here to scare other families from coming. Most of the separations Creel uncovered were happening in one place, evidence that would later become critical to piecing together where and when wide-scale family separations began. The practice appears to be particularly pronounced in West Texas, she wrote, where Border Patrol agents at an October meeting in El Paso acknowledged they were separating families. 2 days later, I landed in El Paso in the late afternoon on assignment. Having missed Creel's article entirely over the holiday weekend, I was focused on the cratering morale in the Border Patrol and was eager to learn more about the death of Agent Martinez. You don't have to drive far outside of the city until the freeway opens up and the speed limit hits 80. A wide and vast landscape unspools before us. We're practically flying, with the windows down, and it's clear that Arnie, whom I've been teamed up with since covering the 2016 presidential campaign, is taking full advantage of the open road. We were going too fast, rushing out of the airport and into our rental car and off to our destination like so many times before. But we were in such a blind hurry that we missed the family separation story entirely. In fact, we were driving right by it. Zooming past the giant Border Patrol checkpoint on Interstate 10, we carried on, en route to shoot a feature story on the failure of the Trump administration's hiring push for the agency. They were failing, in part, because potential recruits were being scared off by the prospect of the dangers of the job, and, in the case of where we were headed, an extremely remote assignment. It's just before 5 in the evening local time, and to my right outside the passenger window, the sun looks like it's about to set into Juarez, Mexico, which is weird because I thought the sun sets to the west and not to the south. Also outside my window are fluffy white clouds and blue sky and a yellowish-orange horizon and mountains and telephone poles and low shrubs and cacti. It's all going by so fast. If you wanted to order a border sunset for a Hollywood movie, this would be it. The air smells different, doesn't it? I ask Arnie. There's not a wall out there, at least I don't think, but now there's not enough light to see for sure. And I'm not thinking about any of that anyway. I'm talking with Arnie about having a son, and when he and his wife will have a baby, and we're listening to the news on satellite radio. I've never been to this part of the border before. Where we're headed, the Big Bend sector is as remote as you can get along the U.S.-Mexico dividing line. As we speed along, night falls on West Texas, and the murder mystery of Agent Martinez remains unsolved for a ninth day. You think he was killed right out here? It has to be somewhere nearby. The sun also sets on dozens of children alone and scared without their parents. They are out there in the darkness, invisible to us. But it's not the night that's hiding them. We did come here to cover a border story, just the wrong one. Since Donald Trump announced his presidential campaign by calling Mexicans rapists and criminals, his anti-immigrant policies have been front and center. I live in Los Angeles, a majority-minority city with a nearly 50% Latinx population, where Trump's rhetoric and policies directly affect millions of people. I didn't set out to be an immigration reporter, but it's hard to miss big stories important to immigrant communities as an Angeleno. After I graduated college, I marched, then vlogged in 2005 and 2006, respectively, at the Gran Marchas, huge protests for comprehensive immigration reform that filled some of Los Angeles' busiest streets with seas of people. Almost a decade later, when I was working for the now-shuttered cable network Pivot, I drove my mom's station wagon to learn who was caught up in President Obama's record number of deportations and met a bunch of people who grew up in Southern California just like I did. One of my first assignments at MSNBC was to get the reactions of migrant farm workers in California's Central Valley to the Pope's visit to the United States. One man wanted Francis to, quote, tell Trump to calm down. In between the 2016 Republican and Democratic conventions, we made the trip to a place outside of San Diego where there is no border fence and asked the Border Patrol if they needed Trump's wall. We reported that most undocumented immigrants come by air, not the southern border, that most drugs come through ports of entry, and while visiting Trump's big, beautiful prototypes, we watched a little girl wearing a pink backpack and her family declare asylum at the base of it after they were apprehended by officers on horseback. All that is to say, if you called my cell phone on this drive and asked me if I had my finger on the pulse of immigration policy, I would have told you yes. I would have been wrong. This trip to El Paso was a prime example of how wrong I was. We planned to overnight in Marfa, the small West Texas desert city where we'd meet our guide from the Border Patrol the next morning. We made it just in time for an unexpectedly cold night, the temperatures dipping into the 30s. And we had an unexpectedly fancy dinner with Dana Roker and Rob Colville, the top-notch crew Arnie and I had started working with during the 2016 campaign at Hotel St. George, where we had booked rooms. Are we really in Texas? That night, what seemed like all night, a cargo train chugged by as I tried to sleep. My bed shook. Even the TV on with those foam earplugs stuffed in my ear canals didn't do the trick. This is going to be a long night, I thought. And then I passed out. The next morning, I woke up and headed downstairs for breakfast with the team, flipping through the local paper for stories about the late Agent Martinez and the mystery surrounding his death. At the same time, Border Patrol agent Javier Prieto was on his way to meet us at the Marfa Border Patrol station, where we'd set off on a drive through mountainous, windy desert roads to a place where the Rio Grande is not even a few yards wide. Multiple migrants had died trying to cross the border here over the summer. Patterns were unusual. Did he know anything about the families being separated in the sector next door? Had he separated any families himself? Those were not questions I knew to ask. And today wasn't going to be the day I figured that out. December 3rd, 2017. Over 2 weeks after Commander Jonathan White told his own leadership and CBP Commissioner Kevin McAleenan that ORR was seeing an increase in children separated from their parents, and after the Houston Chronicle reported the same, McAleenan finally got back to White. "Thanks again for this, Jonathan," he wrote White in an email asking for a password for the spreadsheet containing information about separated children White had sent him on November 17th. "You should have seen a change the past 10 days or so." McAleenan meant that he had ordered an end to a family separation pilot program that had been taking place in the El Paso sector. McAleenan learned more about the program after asking for details on separations from Border Patrol Chief Carla Provost, who in turn had her deputy, Gloria Chavez, quote, dig deeper. Data showed that during the El Paso pilot program, apprehensions of families dropped by 64%, which, as Commander White and ORR staff suspected, they carried out between July and November. Ready to order the end of the pilot program himself, McAleenan further pressed Provost about it. I know, boss. I shut it down already, she told him. Despite McAleenan's assurance to White that he would, quote, have seen a change regarding separations, White remained skeptical. He told colleagues as much when he forwarded McAleenan's email on December 5th. Sorry, meant to share this yesterday. As you know, we did some lobbying of CBP leadership on the separations issue. Kevin advises we should be seeing the numbers of separations decrease. We shall see what the future holds. White's intuition was right. Less than a week later, on December 13th, he received an email from an ORR colleague who had been on the phone with Gloria Chavez that day. The deputy chief had revealed the Border Patrol was still looking to expand the, quote, prosecution of parents. But the ORR staffer reported to White that Chavez said the larger scale policy would require the sign-off of the new Secretary of Homeland Security, Kirstjen Nielsen, who had just assumed her post. December 5th, 2017. Kirstjen Nielsen was confirmed as President Trump's second Secretary of Homeland Security by a vote of 62-37, 10 Democrats joining Republicans in tapping her for the post responsible for the United States Immigration Enforcement System. Her now former boss, John Kelly, left his post as DHS Secretary in July to become President Trump's Chief of Staff, which set off a game of musical chairs. At his urging, his chief of staff at DHS and then aide in the White House, Nielsen, a former George W. Bush aide who worked on his administration's widely panned Hurricane Katrina response, was nominated as his permanent successor. Her deputy, Chad Wolf, would soon become her chief of staff at DHS. Before Nielsen was confirmed, she had to appear before the Senate Homeland Security and Governmental Affairs Committee to face questions from the U.S. senators who would decide her fate, which she did in early November. Senator Kamala Harris had intended to bring up a question about family separations, but didn't quite get to it. I am running out of time, California's junior senator said, so I just want to ask you one more question. Do you agree with a policy that would expedite deportation of unaccompanied minors who are coming from those Central American countries? Senator Harris was referring to a goal of both the Trump administration and some in the Obama administration to quickly deport unaccompanied Central American migrant children to deter others from coming. I believe in reuniting children with their families, Nielsen said, in a bizarre bit of foreshadowing. If their families are not here, Senator Harris interrupted, pointing out to Nielsen that doing so would only put them back in the same desperate circumstances they had fled in the first place. Well, Nielsen replied, in that case, I would certainly want to work with you to understand more about the implications. Though Kelly, the nominee's former boss, had confirmed on CNN 9 months earlier that a family separation plan was in the works, and Lomi Creel had confirmed it was now happening, Nielsen was asked exactly zero questions by the panel about the practice on that 8th day of November. Senator Harris submitted in writing the questions she ran out of time to ask about family separations, and by law, Nielsen was forced to answer under oath. The responses were attached to the official transcript of Nielsen's confirmation hearing. The Young Center for Immigrant Children's Rights has reported a dramatic increase in the number of requests for child advocates for children separated from parents by immigration authorities this year. For example, in New York, there's been nearly a fourfold increase in such requests as compared to the same quarter of the prior year. 1. If confirmed, will you issue written guidance to make clear that mothers are not to be separated from their children at the border? I am not familiar with the increase cited in the question nor its causation, Should I be confirmed, I will work with Acting Commissioner McAleenan and Acting Director Homan to understand the current practice and policy and, if necessary, work with them to issue additional guidance. 2. What are you doing to ensure families are not being systematically separated and, if they are, what steps is the department taking to ensure reunification and communication of separated family members? As the nominee, I currently have no role in what you describe. If confirmed, I will review current policies to ensure DHS is not unnecessarily separating families. My understanding is that while ICE has limited capacity family residential detention facilities to house alien family members, the separation of alien families generally occurs outside the United States when one or both parents, particularly those from countries in Central America, depart their countries and illegally enter the United States, leaving behind their children, or the parents arrange for illicit human smuggling organizations to smuggle their children into the United States. In either case, the children arriving at or between ports of entry entering the United States without their parents or legal guardians are processed as unaccompanied alien children, UAC, upon apprehension, and pursuant to the Trafficking Victims Protection Reauthorization Act, TVPRA, the Department of Health and Human Services, DHHS, not DHS, has the sole statutory authority and obligation to provide for the care and custody of such children and to seek reunification with their parents or suitable sponsors in the United States. I am aware that ICE does have an online detainee locator system to help family members locate individuals in immigration custody. 3. If you are confirmed, will you report to me whether DHS is currently drafting or considering a policy to separate families at the border? If confirmed, I commit to sharing additional policy guidance and appropriate information with Congress. 4. Will you commit to review what procedures exist when U.S. Customs and Border Protection, CBP, makes such a decision, i.e. reviews opportunity for parents to be represented in challenging a separation? I will. The inconsistency between Nielsen's answers and the public reporting was troubling for Senator Harris, who was one of the Democrats who voted against her along with 36 others just days after the Houston Chronicle exposed the secret family separations pilot program in El Paso. 10 days after Nielsen was sworn in, Jean Hamilton, the 30-something counselor to Attorney General Jeff Sessions, sent a message to Nielsen's deputy, Chad Wolf, asking about the status of 10 decision memos they had been working on during the interim tenure of Acting DHS Secretary Elaine Duke, who had ascended to the acting secretary position after John Kelly moved to the White House. These nominal memos were actually policy proposals that would require the signature of the Homeland Security Secretary. Wolf and Hamilton had until recently been colleagues at DHS, working on policy issues first for John Kelly as senior counselor, then for Duke, and now Nielsen. "Any new ones make it up to you yet?" Hamilton asked Wolf in a series of emails later obtained by my colleague Julia Ainsley. "Sorry for the delay, Gene. Yes, a number of them have been signed out. We consolidated the 10 memos into 8 and have signed out 4 of them. We're working to get the others out the door." Hamilton was excited. "Just let me know if I can do anything to help get them teed up." Just over an hour later, Wolf wrote back again, this time with an unusual request. Wolf asked Hamilton to keep, quote, close hold of what he was about to send. He did not even want Hamilton to forward the documents to Stephen Miller, President Trump's right hand on immigration. "I plan to once Kevin, Tom, and Francis cut in on it," referring to Kevin McAleenan, the acting Customs and Border Protection Commissioner, Tom Homan, the head of ICE, and Francis Cisna, the head of U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, which manages legal immigration in the United States. "The goal," Wolf wrote, "is to give S1, Secretary Nielsen, an idea of what she can do right away versus actions that will take months plus to implement." The second item on his list of 16 proposals was separating families. Separate family units. Announced that DHS is considering separating family units, placing the adults in adult detention and placing the minors under the age of 18 in the custody of HHS as unaccompanied alien children, UACs, because the minors will meet the definition of unaccompanied alien child, i.e. 1, has no lawful immigration status in the U.S., 2, has not attained the age of 18, and 3, has no parent or legal guardian in the U.S., or no parent or legal guardian in the U.S. is available to provide care and physical custody. See 6 U.S.C. 279G2. This will require close coordination with HHS to ensure that sufficient capacity is available to detain the UACs. Advocacy groups are aware that this policy shift may occur and therefore are seeking to identify families who have been separated in order to bring a class action lawsuit. Hence, close coordination with DOJ will also be required. Status, currently under consideration, dependent on policy determination. Implement. Direct DHS OPA to develop messaging options. A. Once legal coordination between DHS, HHS, and DOJ is complete, begin separating family units as stated above. Status. Currently under consideration, dependent on policy determination. Implement. Secretarial memo needed for full implementation. 11 days after Kirstjen Nielsen was sworn in as Secretary of Homeland Security, her staff and others inside the Trump administration were working aggressively to put a potential nationwide family separation policy in front of her. The exact scenario Senator Harris asked Nielsen to report back to her on. Nielsen did not, nor did her staff. Hamilton, the loyal aide to the Attorney General, was looking forward to digging into and giving comments to Wolf on potential new policies, including separations. Happy to, he wrote. Have to go do pictures with the kids and can review this PM. And won't share with anyone. I am a citizen of Honduras and came to the United States seeking asylum. I received a negative determination of my initial asylum interview, credible fear interview, and an immigration judge affirmed it, so I have a final order of removal but have not been deported. I came to the United States on or around February 18, 2018, with my biological son, RZAR, who is 3 years old. He's also from Honduras and seeking asylum. When we came to the United States, we turned ourselves in at the border in Brownsville, Texas, and I said that I wanted to seek asylum. Shortly after arriving, I was told that I was going to be separated from my son. There were no doubts expressed that I was my son's biological father, and I have a birth certificate to show our relationship. I also had my son's vaccination records and his passport. They did not tell me that I was a danger to my son or was abusive. They told me that they had to separate me from my son because I had a prior removal order and they did not have any places to detain fathers and children. I was sent to the South Texas Detention Center around February 19, 2018. My son was sent to an ORR facility in or near El Paso, Texas. I have not seen him for over 2 months. I worry about RZAR constantly and don't know when I will see him. We have talked on the phone several times, but I do not have many minutes and I do not always get an answer when I call. I know that RZAR is having a very hard time, detained all by himself without me. My son has already suffered a lot because his mother disappeared about 6 months ago. He's too young to understand that she was taken from us, but he knows she is gone and he misses her. That has been very hard on him. He's only a 3-year-old in a strange country and needs his parent. I hope I can be with my son very soon. I declare under penalty of perjury under the laws of the United States of America that the foregoing is true and correct based on my personal knowledge. Executed in Pearsall, Texas, on April 25th, 2018. Declaration of Mr. A. Miss L versus ICE.